It is cold and snowy today, but that's not stopping winter weeds. They're still growing. This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Today on our gardening show, we're going to talk about how to manage those winter weeds and what we should be doing or not doing to clean up our gardens. And of course, our experts are here for the full hour to answer your questions. Joining me now are Campbell County Extension Office Horticulture Agent Sarah Imbus. Welcome back, Sarah.
So good to be here.
Turner Farm Community Garden Program Director Peter Huttinger. Thanks for being here, Peter.
Yeah, good afternoon.
And the Crow Nose Naturalist, Carol Mundy. Welcome back to you too, Carol.
Happy to be in the studio.
Great to have you here. If you have questions for our experts, and we know you do, give us a call at 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. Carol, I think a lot of people think about everything in the garden is dead right now, that there's nothing happening, that this time of year our gardens are just dormant. But what is the reality? Stuff's actually growing
right? Absolutely. Yeah, it's hard to imagine that when there's a snow cover on. But be thankful for that snow cover because it does blanket, you know, and really kind of insulates from these super hard freezes that we're having. But I encourage you, if you were to walk around the edge of your house where snow has not gathered and it's gotten a little sunlight, you have a microclimate, chances are you may find dandelion blooming. I've found dandelion blooming, speedwells. We can see where bittercress is already coming up, dead nettle, henbit. So I've been called out walking around buildings, maybe even this one, going, oh, look at that. Yeah. So I'm always on the hunt to see what happens to take up in any little space.
You mentioned some weeds there. Are those the most common winter weeds around here? Or are there others people could be looking out for?
Those are some of the top ones. I think with bittercress, some people have a not so nice name for that particular weed. Snapweed is the polite name on bittercress. I've seen it growing and blooming in a mulch pile in December when there's not snow.
Ah. Peter, what should we be doing about these weeds? Are there different strategies for different types of weeds?
Yeah, well, at this time of year, what gets tricky is because the ground is frozen, but also then when it thaws out, it's very wet. So if you go in too early and start pulling weeds, you're pulling out all your soil.
Yeah.
So that's something to kind of, and it's so gummy, soil so damp and clay that if you try and use a shuffle hoe or any kind of hoe on it, it just gets all clogged up. One thing you can do at this point is you can tarp. You can put covering on it, or you can put down pieces of cardboard to try and smother it out. But at this point, it's kind of a little bit of a wait until the soil dries up and things warm up a little bit. But, you know, there's the old saying, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. I mean, the best time to deal with spring weeds is in the late fall.
Hmm.
And so if you clean up your beds well, sheet compost with on top of the beds or put down straw or tarp them, you know, that's going to give you a jump start in the spring.
And you're talking specifically about veggie.
Oh, right. Yes, I'm talking about vegetable gardening, not flowers. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
You do not want to tarp your perennial. Yeah, don't. Cone flowers don't go for that. Yeah, thank you for bringing that up.
Are there any weeds we should just learn to kind of peacefully coexist with?
I think so. There's, I mean, when you see, I jumped on top of Sarah there. When I look at, you go to now the local farmers markets and they're selling purslane, I've got that in my yard. It's good to eat. Or ground cherry. Just, you know, those are later summer weeds, but people call those weeds when here's some really good food. Don't waste it.
Sarah, did you want to add to that?
I just, you know, I think it's been a year. I don't know, Carol and Peter, we've had these conversations of eating our weeds or something like that. And I just caution people because let's define what a weed is.
Yeah.
And so a weed is just a plant out of place. And so just keep that in mind. You know, I think there are a lot of weeds, not for edible purposes or medicinal, but also just for our pollinators. Like, you know, henbit, and those beautiful, I think they're beautiful.
Yeah.
Beautiful lavender colored, dainty little flowers and just like dandelion are some of the first food sources for our pollinators. And so I just think it's lovely. And it's just educating those as what's a weed, what's not a weed, and understanding the environment.
I agree. You've got to take advantage of those early bloomers. And we're not just talking about honeybees. They're not native. But we have lots of early coming, you know, native bees that come out. And so they rely on those early blooming weeds, if you will. That's their first food.
Yeah, and also if we think about lawns, like in the vegetable beds, you know, I don't want a dandelion or I don't want violets, any of these things. But, you know, in the grass around our gardens, whether at home or at one of the Turner Farm community gardens, you know, the white Dutch clover we see as an asset because of bee forage and native pollinator forage. And so, you know, to kind of think about how we approach these kinds of things.
And why do you not want violets or dandelions in your vegetable beds? Because are they? Because they're
consuming
resources. Well,
it's a weed. They compete. They compete with other plants. Even like purslane, we'll leave some of that around. But one year we just let it kind of grow very heavily in one section underneath tomatoes, and the following year there was like it was kind of uncontrollable about the purslane coming back so strongly. So, but we do leave always a little bit of that.
We're talking about gardening for the full hour today, and you can join the conversation. Just call 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. Okay, we were talking before. Peter just said, ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. Sarah, is this a good time of year to kind of clean up our gardens? What should we be doing this time of year?
Very great question. Really, right now, we should just be enjoying the beautiful white snow that is protecting our grounds. And honestly, I think Peter mentioned this is, you know, with the moisture in our beds, we really don't want to be working in our soil right now for various reasons, further compacting. And it's just not a best practice. So I know that was kind of a generic response, but really, it's just kind of a waiting game. So in the future, though, we really should have started in the fall with some management strategies. But, you know, I always bring this up, you know, having your tools ready when the environment allows, because, you know, we just want to make sure there's ready. And some of my approaches are definitely not just relying on one method. So I use mechanical, I use it could be chemical, either organic or not, depending upon the application, of course. And all of these have its own application. So really right now, kind of to reiterate, nothing to do at this moment, but definitely having your tools ready. And in addition is researching what have been those problematic weeds in your space, because there are winter weeds, as this show is highlighting, but there are summer weeds, there are perennial and annual in those various seasons. So it's also researching and understanding what weeds have been problematic. You know, if you keep a journal or you already know that certain weeds are problematic, then reach out to us and see, like, what is the life cycle of this weed? And that way you can implement the best management practice to prevent or reduce that weed in your space.
We have a caller on the line. Hey, Scott, thanks for listening. Thanks for calling. What's your question?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I was wondering about how to prepare for propagating seeds for spring planting. I especially have some wisteria pods. Get a good crop of those, but also interested in like ironweed and things like that. I understand I should maybe start them indoors at some point.
Okay, thank you so much. Who'd like to take that one?
Go ahead. Nope, he's got nothing. All right. Well, first of all, when you were talking about some of these things, could have been, you know, kind of a winter sow where you had them outside in a flat, protected from critters digging them up, of course, and allow them to go to that freeze and thaw. So you have to do a little bit of that research to understand what their normal cycle would be. And then if you have saved those seeds, the best way to save them, should they just be dry? Do they need to be cleaned and put in the freezer or refrigerator? So understanding what they might need, some of them might need to be scarified, so they have to be roughed up or boiling water poured on them. So I would take the two that you mentioned, and I think you said, what did you say, wisteria?
Yeah.
Okay. So look up the type of wisteria if you know. Just keep in mind that we we have a native wisteria or Kentucky wisteria, which has a white bloom, and then the non-native, which is purple, which can be kind of like a, well, it just kind of takes over. And then ironweed, again, go and look up the propagation for ironweed and see what the best practice is for that. But you can do winter sowing. They don't have to be brought inside.
Great. Thank you. Peter, did you want to add anything?
Oh, well, no, it's just, you know, what she was talking about, winter and late fall sowing for a lot of these things, like with your natives or even a grass seed and things like that, is actually a good time to do that. Mm-hmm. And then let them come back. And then often with things like ironweed and some of black-eyed Susans and things like that, they're going to self-seed.
Yeah, right.
So, you know, you'll be thinning those in the spring.
Right. Okay. Free flowers.
Yeah, free, and share them with your friends. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, thanks so much, Scott. We appreciate your listening. Thanks for calling, and hope your propagating goes well. Again, we're talking about gardening for the full hour. You can join the conversation. Give us a call, 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. Carol Sarah was saying that, you know, fall is really the best time to sort of clean up the garden, that there's, with the ground being so wet right now and clumpy now, you shouldn't be messing with the soil too much. Is there such a thing as cleaning up too much or being overly anxious to really tidy up that garden?
I think so, but that's a personal feeling about that. And again, are we talking about veggie beds or your perennial bed? I clean up the veggie beds. There might be some, and we were just talking about that, Peter and I, before we went on the air, and I would think Sarah would be onto that too, would to do some winter cover crops. Mm-hmm. So that you have some things that will grow through these tremendous variations, but allow for that soil to stay intact and also get some good nutrients back into the soil.
Yeah, with the vegetable beds, we use two basic techniques. And one is a cover crop that you'll either cut back or turn in the spring, or else some of them will actually, like hairy vetch, will die back over winter and then come back in the spring. And then other crops will, there's some what are called winter kill mixes, like those that are generally in this weather like we're having now, it'll die back and then you have dead organic mass on top of your garden that you can plant into or lightly turn into the soil. And the other is we do what we call sheet composting or top dressing. And then after we weed the beds in the fall, we will put 2 to 4 inches of compost on top. You can also use a bed of straw on top to kind of hold things. But one thing that also you can, with the freezing and warming up, so the water will get into the soil and expand and contract. And so another thing we do is that the top surface is sometimes when we're weeding the bed, you'll have like gaps in the soil. And sometimes we'll go through with a hoe or a shovel. And just on the top surface is what we call clot the soil. And then we top dress on top of it. And then that compost starts to work into the soil, and then when it freezes and thaws during the winter, it expands and contracts and actually kind of breaks everything down and evens out the soil. And so that's another little trick that you can try. And by doing that, also you're going to reduce greatly the amount of early spring weeds that you have.
Sarah, did you want to add anything to all that?
I agree. Yeah.
Okay.
I would say that with perennial beds, don't be so over anxious. I mean, just think about, there are a lot of really great insects that will require the stems of some of those plants. So let them finish out. And in some plants, one comes to mind that's white. It's a white wing stem, frostweed. And if you allow that to stay, you get frost flowers where the sap comes up from the soil layer and through capillary action goes up this breaking dry stem, and now you have frost. It looks like cotton candy coming out. So why cheat yourself out of that? And don't be so anxious to clean it up.
Okay. We have another caller on the line. Hey, Rob, thanks for calling.
Hi. Yeah, so I have a lot of uncomposted compost in my compost bins. And even some grass from last year and with shredded leaves. And I was wondering, I have raised beds, and the soil is very workable. I was in the garden a little while ago, and before the snow, it's very workable now. So I was wondering, is it smart to put the uncomposted compost, kitchen scraps and such, in the garden as soon as I can, and then later compost in the soil.
Sarah, I'm going to let you take an initial crack at that one.
Yeah, so it's really hard to give a yes or no answer without really understanding what it looks like. I say that because when I think of kitchen scraps, it could be all of our vegetables and different volumes can influence your overall compost. And so when I think of that, I would say no, because it's not, you're not going to heat that up to biodegrade. And I, especially those living in urban areas, I don't want to attract our unwanted critters into those spaces, for example. So, you know, if you think of a compost pile, that heap on the inside is going to, it's going to heat up, right? And so it helps the decomposition. So I would worry if you're including or integrating kitchen scraps. Now, if it's grass clippings, which is high in nitrogen, which helps increase the decomposition rate, and you have primarily chopped up leaves and things like that, if you can't really tell what the compost is, like pieces, and it's already starting to turn brown, it may have an earthy smell, I'd say sure, why not? But again, you know, I don't really like to give a yes or no answer, though. Feel free to send me an email with some pictures, and I can maybe direct you more. But, you know, I don't know if any others have any thoughts on that.
Well, in the community gardens at Turner Farm, we're using raised beds, not wooden boxes, but row beds. And what we do in the gardens is that we isolate one row and actually do the composting in that entire bed. So at the Price Hill Community Garden, the beds are about 45 feet. So we'll have like three or four of these beds at different stages acting as active compost piles. And then at the end, they're tarped or covered with straw, allowed to sit for a couple months or over winter. And then we just take that bed and turn it over onto the next row, and that becomes the compost pile. And then the remaining, you know, the finished compost then is at the bottom. And so it's like kind of a rotational thing. Now, if you're using wooden raised beds like the gentleman is talking about, you know, it might be a little trickier. But, I mean, if you wanted to seasonally have one of your bed just be the compost pile and then rotate, you know, seasonally like that, that you could do that. But I really agree with Sarah. You really don't want to put things on until it's pretty much finished. I mean, overwintering, if it's 80% finished up, you know, the winter will take care of the rest of it. But you do not want to put, you know, raw in things. And in terms of animals getting into your compost too, they will. But the way to greatly reduce that is don't put in any dairy products, and certainly no meat or bones. Mm-hmm. In large composting operations, you can take care of that. But in most home operations, I really strongly not putting with no protein, no animal products in your compost.
Anything you wanted to add, Carol?
Well, I have kind of a wide open compost pile, and I don't put any, you know, meat or dairy or anything. And we actually set up kind of a trail cam to see who comes to visit. And so there are quite a number of visitors that, especially in the evening hours, it's kind of like, you know, TV for nature nerds.
Yeah. What kind of visitors?
Oh, we've got coyote, we've got a couple different kinds of beautiful skunks, you know, a few raccoons, a few possums, which we're okay with that. But as both Sarah and Peter had said, I would never go and throw the banana peels in the grass. Well, the grass clippings maybe a little bit, but I'm not going to put any of that in my veggie beds.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for that question, Rob. We appreciate it. Best of luck with your garden beds. We're going to continue our gardening show after a short break. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. We're back with our February gardening show, and our experts are here for the full hour to answer your questions. My guests are Campbell County Extension Office Horticulture Agent Sarah Imbus, Turner Farm Community Garden Program Director Peter Huttinger, and the Crow Nose Naturalist Carol Mundy. If you have questions for them or gardening thoughts you'd like to share, give us a call at 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. Sarah, what tips do you have for cleaning up dead twigs and branches? I know we don't want to mess with the soil too much right now, but some of us, I won't name names myself, I am one of those people, might have some dead twigs and branches kind of sitting around that maybe we should have cleaned up earlier. What are your tips for that?
So great question. So if you can put it in a compost pile, you know, usually the size of a thumb, or less, and kind of break it up. If you can chip it up, that's one thing. If you can clean it up in areas, I'm just thinking of our education gardens. Have I picked up things and twigs and gotten rid of them? Yes, but I don't always do that. I'm not as a, clean gardener, if you will. Perhaps firewood, you know. And I also think sometimes it creates beauty in the garden. I don't always do a great job cleaning up, but I also like to create habitat, you know, leaves and winter grasses. I keep up for little critters to, you know, to have a little habitat. So, you know, if there's any broken or large things like that, by all means, yes, get that out so it's not a nuisance or hazardous to the landscape or your community. But I don't know. I just kind of let it be right now. I hope that was an okay answer.
Yeah. What about you, Carol? Are you pro twig?
I'm pro twig. Now, I mean, you know, if there's no snow on the ground and you happen to be walking through that area of the yard, you might have some inclination to at least pick it up in the spot where you're walking. But I'm fully invested in what Sarah said in terms of leaving it for a little winter structure. And birds will also use some of those as a little bit of cover. You know, like right now, we're only putting a little seed on top of the snow. So if there are a few of those kinds of twigs or smaller branches, that gives them a little place to hide instead of in a wide open bird feeder. And then they end up as food for the red-shouldered hawk. That's important, too.
Peter, do you have any other twig advice you'd like to give?
Well, no, I mean, if you're talking about, you know, like a lot of people use their ornamental grasses, they'll let those stand over winter mm-hmm. for an architectural detail. And we do that with a lot of in our perennial flower beds and stuff. We'll wait to take things down in the spring. But I do think it is like an environment for not only birds, but also for pollinating insects. And so there's, you know, not all insects you want in a garden, but there are some beneficials right. that you want to provide a habitat for.
Yeah.
And I've noticed recently that a lot of people talking about not cleaning up your perennial flower beds till later in the or early spring, because you want to protect the seedlings that are coming up, but also the, you know, the native pollinators.
Right.
We have a couple of questions to get to. We have a question from Alex. Alex writes, does anyone have an effective way to get rid of lesser celandine? It's now in my compost pile, so I'm afraid to use my compost for fear of spreading the rhizomes. Sarah, did I hear a groan from
yeah.
you?
A collective
I'm
groan.
Like,
all three of us.
Yeah. Sorry, I'm not in the studio because a lot of times I enjoy looking at body language. And so just to give everyone a sense of what I look like right now, I have my eyes closed with my hands over my eyes and just like and crouching over a little bit with disgust. So anyway, so that is it's a newer ish problematic weed. I don't know of any benefit that it has, and anyone that may want to chime in on that, it is easily moved by the hooves of deer because its shallow root structure can easily be uplifted from the soil, and it thrives in all different types of soils, soil types, soil moisture levels, shade. It doesn't mind that. It doesn't mind sun. So it Yes. So there are lookalikes. Native and other perennial lookalikes. So we are educating folks on that. Working with the University of Kentucky and our forestry specialist, Dr. Ellen Crocker, you know, it goes back and forth. You know, when this first started becoming an issue, and I had a lot of calls in Campbell County, and especially in our urban homeowner areas, you know, it was all about, well, let's smother it out with cardboard and mulch, and let's spot treat when needed, trying to prove, and in, especially in our urban sectors in Campbell County, a lot of deer activity. So let's not put bird feeders up. Let's try to discourage, deer. So put fencing up. And all of that is just, I mean, I have to laugh because, you know, that was like 3 years ago when we started these conversations. And it's like, well, that doesn't help much. So right now, I don't have an answer. Though what I would add for any eradication program of any invasive weed in parks and communities, and even in our backyard, we have to replant. So no matter if it's the dandelion that you're trying to get rid of, you have to replant with the fescue that you want to outcompete that, right? So what we're trying to do is outcompete. So again, if we are in a meadows kind of situation, working with parks, for example, okay, well, let's remove these in small areas. And again, small areas, let's quadrant sections off and start in small spaces or small areas. And then let's add back to that space to help outcompete these nuisance pests, aka weeds. So I'll get off my bandwagon. I feel like I keep saying this. I don't have a clear answer. But I want people to be aware of what this weed is. Kudzu is here as well. And that's another that thing grows like 18 inches a day or something nuts. And so we have to be aware of this because it is being very detrimental to our ecosystems. So I'll stop.
Peter, is Alex's instinct right that if you have lesser celandine in your compost pile, you don't want to spread it all over something?
Yes.
Okay.
And so, like, when we try and pull it out, and if there's, like, a small patch of it I spot, we'll try and dig it out the best we can, but we bag it. And, I mean, I've sometimes even let it go to the landfill, but I generally will, you can put it in your, the brown paper bags that go out for yard waste. But I kind of wonder, are we just spreading
it?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think.
But I don't know at what temperature. I mean, if your compost gets the full temperature, technically it should kill everything. But it's, for a homeowner, it's really difficult to get your compost up to the appropriate temperature. So I would either send it out with yard waste or, unfortunately, to the landfill.
Yeah. I think that one of the things we're missing is that with lesser celandine, there is a tiny little turion, basically a tuber, that can remain in the soil. And when the water level comes up, then it just goes down every little rivulet, so it goes to the next place. And next year, it looks like the yellow brick road. And those tiny turions can be active in the soil for years. It also puts out, when it does come up and it's green and makes the pretty yellow flowers, that's the hypnotizing effect. Oh, it's so beautiful. I want that. No, you don't. And it's also, once it dies off, it cuts out this like mucilaginous slime and the other stuff doesn't come through.
Oh.
So it is a multifaceted attack to try and get rid of it. And I think, Sarah, going at it at small bits at a time is the best way to go for it.
And then following up, like if it's in a yard or something with planting a fescue or whatever grass you want to put in, I would think that would help at least in terms of competing. But question I have is, I don't know if either of you know, I mean, is there a particular grass or another plant that, can tolerate it and choke out the lesser celandine?
Honeysuckle? Just kidding.
Yeah. Well, I mean, because the roots of honeysuckles are also allopathic. They'll kill things around us.
Yeah.
So unfortunately, it might work. But is there
this
something
like the Battle
we want?
Of the Titans. Yeah.
Is there something we want?
Yeah.
We know we don't want kudzu. We know we don't want honeysuckle.
Yeah.
I think it depends on its application. Like if I'm looking at an erosion space, which is very another common place for these, this weed, it's like, okay, well, what kind of maybe evergreen, I'm thinking of like some juniper evergreens, horizontalis cultivars that can spread, fairly quickly and very dense. It is very challenging because, again, this can be in sun, shade, clay, sand. I mean, it's everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And also when just weeds, just management, it's all about the developmental stage. So that is one thing that Dr. Ellen Crocker make sure that we all are aware of in presentations with invasive species removal is, you know, they all have their life cycles, and the best time is a general rule. The best time to control these noxious weeds is at its juvenile stage. So just understanding that, and what does that mean? So yeah, reach out to us if people have particular questions about that.
We got a question about fescue. We were just talking about fescue. Tim says, I have 75,000 square feet of soil that I wish to seed with fescue. When is the best time to do this? Need to have good turf by October.
Wow. Not my bailiwick.
Sarah, do you have advice for that?
Well, I'm more than happy to send you a variety list. So I'm assuming, you know, so there's different types of fescue, tall fescue, fine fescue. You will always want to look for a blend. You'll never want a monoculture or one type of fescue, for example, because they have certain characteristics. Some are more drought tolerant, some are more shade tolerant. Shade sometimes has annual rye in that, so there's a quick germination, so you don't have bare soil. And sometimes I just say, you know, that's a lot of land, so this would be costly. But sometimes it's, you know, well, maybe we need to think of another alternative besides just seed. That would be very costly if we did like, I can't think of the word anyhow. But in looking at the source of where you purchase seed is super important. It's kind of like reading a label for food, right? Mm-hmm. There's a label for seed. So look at that. But a blend is always the best. And I would like to have more conversation with you. Please email me or call me. I'll be back in the office in about 30 minutes and happy to phone with you if you want to chat with me.
Tim was asking specifically about timing. Does the type of fescue change the time that it should be planted?
Yeah, so very good point. I am so sorry. So this is a cool season grass. That's very important to understand, just like cool season vegetables or a cool season weed, right? So they all have their life cycles. So with that being said, is that they prefer cool season temperatures to thrive and to be planted. So the optimal textbook time for fescue is in the fall of the year. Okay. The next best time, they call it snow seeding. So it's like now. What actually is happening is it's just going to sit there dormant until the soil temperature, which is super important. And I have a tool to understand the soil temperature, not atmospheric temperature, but soil temperature reaches a consistently temperature of 55 degrees for 7 to 10 days. That is super important. So again, yes, it's a long-winded answer, but yes, timing is by all means. But I also say, okay, so say you have this project and we're talking spring and you don't want bare soil. I'm like, well, let's think of alternatives. Just go ahead and seed, but know that you might have to reseed in the fall, right? So I really don't like to see bare soil for various reasons. And then to add on top of all that, we have to prep the space, right? Right. So are we talking about this is bare soil? We have weeds already, weed pressure, you know, do we have to start with that issue first? So there's a lot of things going into a turf seeding, but I hope I've given you some direction. But again, happy to have further conversation if you need that.
Great. Well, we will be back to finish up with our February gardening show after a quick break. If you have questions, now is the time to call 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. We're in the home stretch of our February gardening show. My guests are Campbell County Extension Office Horticulture Agent Sarah Imbus, Turner Farm Community Garden Program Director Peter Huttinger, and the Crow Nose Naturalist Carol Mundy. You can join the conversation by calling 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. And if you have a question, we're running out of time, so give us a call right now. We did get a question from Jill. Jill wants to know, how do you kill lamb's ear? Peter, you have any tips?
Well, we've had it, we don't run into that often, but I have had some at home and some of the gardens we've gone in and clean up, and I just simply grub it out, try and get the roots out, and then you can now put down cardboard on top of it and then put mulch on top of that if you want. But I've really not had it be difficult to get rid of, but I don't know whether, you've got, how the patches I deal with are usually like 1 to 2 feet in size, so, but I found it to be fairly easy to eradicate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Can it get out of control, Carol, if you let it?
It tends to creep out into areas, and so, if you just keep mowing it, if it doesn't have leaves to photosynthesize, it's not going to live very long. And, Peter's idea, that you grub it out, you cover that spot. I mean, that one's kind of on the easy side compared to some of these things.
Yeah. Okay. Well, is this a good time of year, Peter, to prune broken or wayward limbs? I'm thinking particularly when it comes to fruit trees. I know you deal with some of those. What are some of the do's and don'ts of proper pruning?
Well, February and March are pruning seasons for fruit trees and also for cleaning up other types of things. You want to do this when the trees are dormant. Now Christmas with the Common Orchard Project is doing pruning workshops right now. So if you go to their website via the Green Umbrella, they'll have some free programming and excellent training. But this is definitely the time to start thinking about that. Yeah. Now, because it's so icy, they were going to actually on past Sunday have a pruning workshop, the Common Orchard Program, and they canceled it because it was snowing. But this is definitely the time to start doing that.
Yeah. But you have to be careful about the way you cut, don't you? So
Correct.
You're not just kind of pruning and chopping willy-nilly, is that right?
Yes. And there's this particular with fruit trees, you're training them to maximize the production of fruit. So there's different trees, like peaches, for instance, you prune to an open vase form, apples, the central leader, and it depends on the fruit tree. So if you have fruit trees, I really recommend getting some training. OSU's Extension Small Fruit Home Production Guide is a good one that's available as a PDF. University of Kentucky has an excellent fruit tree resource bulletin if people want to contact me through the VXU or else through the Turner Farm website. I can send you PDF files of these excellent things. But I really stress it with most gardening, anytime you can get practical experience, take it. Classes are great. We teach classes at Turner Farm as well as other organizations do. But anytime you can just go and volunteer someplace or participate in a community garden and learn how to do it firsthand through instruction by a professional or from peer-based education is really the way to go.
Yeah.
But it is definitely the time.
Yeah. Sarah, is it the time for other trees, too, to maybe consider pruning, or is timing different if it's not a fruit tree?
Yeah, so in a general rule of thumb, dormant season for, ornamental plants is the time, though I do caution, so, some early blooming, there's a general rule of thumb that our spring blooming ornamental plants like red buds, dogwoods, you want to prune after they flower because they bloom on old wood. So if you were to prune now, you're going to be pruning off those flower buds that are going to be opening up hopefully in the next 2.5 months or so. But of course, I always caution people, if you need to prune due to disease damage, structural damage, or whatever, you got to prune. Right? You're not going to hurt the tree. You just may negatively affect the bloom, but it's not going to kill the plant or anything.
Sarah, I'm glad you brought up the thing about early pruning too, because peaches and plums are plants, fruit trees that you probably wait later in the season to bloom. Because what happens when you prune a tree, you're stimulating the plant to want to grow. And because the plums and the peaches are particularly vulnerable to frost, we usually will do those later. And like you said, sometimes I know a couple orchardists with the peaches, they actually won't, until the buds form, they don't do the pruning.
Carol, any tips you'd like to add on that?
I'm right in there with the both of these two, is you really have to know what it is, what the plant is. You know, you've always talked to folks who have completely cut off all their lilacs or whatever the case might be, or their red buds, because they decided this is when they had the time to prune, and then they had no flowers, or they're especially dwarf fruit trees that they end up cutting off the cutting them off before it's really the right time.
Yeah. We have a question from our technical director, Marshall Verbsky. Marshall asks, what about timing for a tree that keeps encroaching over a walkway? Should I wait for growing season to try to stunt the growth? So Marshall wants to punish this tree, prune it and punish it. Anybody have tips there? When does he want it? He really wants to sock it to this tree. Sarah, should he wait until the tree's just about to grow?
No. Okay, so one, what type of tree is it? Yeah. I'm assuming it's an ornamental deciduous tree. And also, as Peter mentioned and I briefly talked about, pruning actually initiates growth. It's promoting growth. So I'm not a cosmetologist, but, you know, when we get our hair cut, we're just cutting off the dead end so it stays healthier and that it grows better, right? And so that's kind of like how trees are. Like, it's not stunting the growth. In fact, it's just you're pruning it so it could send a new bud to initiate new growth. So there are ways to prune that maybe you need to limit up because it's near a walkway and, you know, people's heads are rubbing up against it. I get it. So there are certain cuts where you need to make that actually will callus over and it won't initiate growth. So, you know, if you're not sure, definitely reach out to us and we'll be glad to help you and, you know, pictures and whatnot, but also reaching out to a certified arborist in your community, especially if you're not able safely to get, if you don't have the tools or safely get into the tree canopy. And I mentioned certified arborist because they have proper training and they're also very knowledgeable, but also they have the insurance and different things like that for liability and whatnot. So I know, again, I don't have a clear answer, but don't think that it's going to stunt it. Okay. So it's just proper pruning techniques. And depending upon where this is, I mean, maybe we'll just have to do like a live show on how to proper prune. Yeah.
Live from Marshall Verbsky's house. We're talking gardening and punishing this tree. Yeah. We have a question from Rich. Rich asks, between now and summertime, when's the best time to transplant blueberry bushes and viburnum bushes? Peter, you have thoughts on that?
Well, I think I'll let viburnum go with Sarah, but blueberries you want to is, it can be, again, you're getting new nursery stock and it's dormant. And so transplanting it between now and our first frost date, May 18th, is a good time to do it. But I do want to say for, you know, ribes or small fruit, you know, it's actually fall is the ideal time to plant. And the second best time is like at the season that we're going into now. But if we plant in the spring, remember it's going to go through the heat of the summer. So be sure and mulch it well and to keep it watered. Kind of a rule of thumb, if you're in a drought, you know, like a 5-gallon bucket of water applied around the drip line of the bush or the young fruit tree once a week is a good safety measure in the middle of a drought. But just keep an eye on the moisture. You don't want to drown it, but, you know, you do want to make sure it doesn't completely dry out because it's going to be very delicate the first year.
Sarah, you have thoughts on viburnum bushes?
Transplant is similar to what Peter just said, you know, those woody ornamentals. Fall is the best for sure. Spring is going to, you know, and I always say, well, it's also availability, right? So when are you able to get these plants from your nurseries? If it's a transplant, you know, a lot of times we may share or move plants around. I always say definitely cut it back first. you know, is because it's just easier to move, and then take as much of that root structure as possible. Viburnums are so lovely, and they can send out multiple stems. So just be mindful of that root structure.
Carol, anything you want to add?
Yeah, with the viburnums, I agree. If you cut them back, that you will get, they do want to be multiple stems. And I know if you go to nurseries, you can buy some of these, the viburnums and things like serviceberry, you can buy a single stem. But guess what? It doesn't want to be a single stem. When you see them out in the wild, you don't see
they
as
like
many
friends.
Of them. They want a lot of friends. And so you have to decide if you're going to be continually trimming that. But some of the viburnums are quite aggressive. Some of the natives can infringe on areas. And so you have to decide, is that free plants or are you going to have your feelings hurt and decide you're going to get rid of them?
Yeah. Well, and Peter, you said like sometime in the next few weeks, you said now, but we shouldn't be, if the soil's too wet, should we consider that when transplanting?
Well, you need to consider that. And then you also need to consider, I mean, if it's frozen hard as a rock.
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, in restoration, sometimes people just have to do it when they can do it. But for the homeowner, I would say wait for a more optimal opportunity. And, you know, if you bring things in, you bought it at a nursery too, you know, leave it on your back porch or in partially part shade in your yard, any potted plant that you purchase for a week or so to let it acclimate to your, you know, your particular microclimate also is a good idea.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Spend a little time, get to know your little bush before you plant it.
Same thing with your vegetable starts.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. That's right. Okay. Well, I think we've had a wonderful gardening show. I want to thank all my guests. I've been talking with Campbell County Extension Office Horticulture Agent Sarah Imbus, Turner Farm Community Garden Program Director Peter Huttinger, and the Crow Nose Naturalist Carol Mundy. Thank you all so much for your time today. It's been lots of fun.
It has been. Thanks.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Technical director is Marshall Verbsky, and Rob Fetters composed our theme music. I just want to warn the trees in Marshall's yard that he's coming for you. If you miss our program live, you can listen to Cincinnati Edition. You can find it wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Lucy May. Thanks so much for listening.